Is we live? Yes. You're now tuned into the Rare Podcast, of course. I'm your host for the most, NK, aka the man of the hour, too sweet to be sour. And we are joined by a very, very special guest. Without further ado, I'm going to let her introduce herself. Madam, tell the people who you are and what you do.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jessie, and I am, I would say, a content creator now.
Yes.
So a weird phrase. I don't think I associate myself with that phrase that much. And I make a lot of different type of content, but a lot of it is rooted in storytelling because I would say it's one of my passions. And I'm also a science student. I'm currently studying my master's.
Oh, shit.
So, yeah, that's pretty much a summary of who I am.
Sick. So, like, how did you, like, get into, like, content creation? Like, what made your passion for storytelling translate into something that you wanted to publicize and put out there?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think it originally started from a really young age. I've loved like making YouTube videos. So I would make YouTube videos and then I'd put them up and then I'd delete them. And I had a phase where I was like doing study videos and then I'd delete them. And then I had a phase of doing vlogs and then I'd delete them. And then when I graduated from my undergrad, I wanted to do like a mini series with my friends, but then all of my friends were unreliable. They all kept canceling on me. So I was like, right, I'm going to do the mini series by myself. And it ended up developing into like a podcast and I was exploring different topics. So I was like, okay, if I want people to listen to my podcast, I need to start posting on social media.
Yeah.
And so I'd post on TikTok and then they always tell you on TikTok, post everything, like randomly, not just only one type of thing, but post the variety of who you are. And then I would always find that the ones where I'm talking about how much I love storytelling, people could tell my passion from it. And I was like, okay, like people like this. So let me continue going on with that track.
What would you say is your earliest memory of a story that really like captured your imagination?
That's such a good question. I remember, which is really funny because they're releasing a film from it. I really love reading. I've always been a very big bookworm. And so I remember when I was like 4 or 5, I read like this massive fat book called The Magic Faraway Tree by Enid Bolton. And I just remember, I read that book 4 times in a row. And I remember my dad, like my Nigerian dad was so happy. He's like, she's a reader. Yes, she's so smart. But I just remember loving the world and seeing like the picture so vividly in my brain. And I was like, oh, this is like really powerful, really cool thing. So I would say that's the very first story I remember making me enthralled with how they bring the story together.
Okay, that's sick. That's sick. And it's interesting because you said you're studying neuroscience?
Yes.
So it's interesting, like, because you come from a very like scientific background. Are you somebody when you're analyzing a story, are you quite analytical? Are you looking for like, what are you looking for when it comes to your stories? What are you looking to get out of your stories?
Well, I think I'm a creative person that's quite analytical in nature because that is the discipline in which I explored.
Yeah.
And I think my interest in science has always come from understanding the world. And I think stories are also about understanding the world too. So I think they're quite linked in that manner. So I think when I'm breaking down stories, I think first and foremost, you look for an emotion that's evoked. Does it evoke emotion in me? Does it make me happy when it's supposed to make me happy? Does it make me feel sad? Does it make me question things about myself and the world? And then when I feel an emotion, I question how did they bring that forward? So I think it comes from an emotional place first, and then I deconstruct very analytically. Okay, how did it do this? Was it music? Was it the, like, what did they do to make me feel this way? I think that's how I approach it.
That's amazing. Well, before we get into like the main topics, I want to play a little game with you. And it's a simple game of one's got to go. So I'm going to give you 4 options and you've got to pick one thing out of the 4 options that has to be erased forever.
I'm really good at these games.
Cool.
I'm very decisive.
Cool. So we're talking about super animated series.
Mm-hmm.
So the Young Justice series.
Okay.
X-Men 90 series, which includes the new reboot.
Okay.
Spectacular Spider-Man.
Okay.
Or Justice League, and that includes Unlimited.
Spectacular Spider-Man. Sorry.
Oh!
That's actually quite easy. I was a bit scared when you started off with Young Justice. I was like, oh, am I really going to struggle? And then you did X-Men and you Spectacular Spider-Man. I was like, okay, I can live without.
I've been wounded. I've been offended.
What would you pick?
For me, out of that thing, it has to be either, it's probably Justice League. I think Spectacular Spider-Man is the best Spider-Man adaptation, Peter Parker Spider-Man adaptation ever. Like, I think that is, it for me, it provides the definitive versions of so many Spider-Man characters.
Okay.
When it comes to the relationship between Peter and Gwen, even the introduction of Mary Jane while Gwen is still present. And I think
people forget about that a lot, that whole crossover.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it really handles the ensemble of the Spider-Man universe better than I've seen any other adaptation do. And it's granted, because it's in the medium of television, it has more time. Mm-hmm. But then there's been so many other television adaptations that haven't quite hit the mark, whether it's Ultimate Spider-Man, whether it's, I can't remember the one that came right after Ultimate, but I think Spectacular is the one.
The Amazing Spider-Man?
I think, was there Amazing Spider-Man animated series?
Don't quote me on
there
that.
Might have been, but yeah. I know there was like Spectacular Spider-Man, Ultimate Spider-Man, one, and then there's Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man that just came out, which people have told me is good, but I have a thing for like CGI, and that CGI in that one looks ugly.
Yeah, it's not an appealing medium to watch. I get what you're meaning about like the Spectacular Spider-Man, but I think Spider-Man is one of those heroes where I've always been somewhat satisfied with how they represent him.
That's fair.
Whereas Justice League, they butcher that so often. Whereas Justice League Unlimited, the Justice League animated series, are probably like the only source at the moment that we have of like a good Justice League. And I think same with like X-Men, less so, but still again, like there's a sense of purity when it comes to the animated series, and Young Justice is phenomenal.
It is.
So that's why I was like, I can live without a Spider-Man.
And it's funny because Young Justice and Spectacular Spider-Man were both Greg Wiseman projects. And
he did the Green Lantern animated series too. That was great.
And it's just like both of those series I adore. Like I slightly like Spectacular Spider-Man more, but like, because of Young Justice, the later seasons didn't hit as much as the first two. But Young Justice season one and season two, perfection. Like
phenomenal TV. Especially for something that was supposed to be geared towards kids. It's like phenomenal. The way they bring in different casts that you don't even talk about. The character development.
And it managed to like legitimize like C-list villains. Like I never like cared about Sportsmaster.
Who knows Sportsmaster?
But then Young Justice really like put like these like C-tier villains on a pedestal. Even obviously Vandal Savage is a character that appears in DC Comics a lot, but he's not, I wouldn't consider him an A-lister.
Yeah.
But Vandal Savage with the rest of the light, like he was running things, and he took shine over characters like Lex Luthor. And I was like, whoa, like they're doing a lot with fringe characters in the universe. They're not just relying on the heavy hitters, which I really appreciate.
And I think that's like really good storytelling, because when you have IP that's so big, like superheroes, like DC, and like doing the Joker, everybody has an expectation of the Joker.
Exactly.
So there is power in pulling from these C-listers and giving them your own interpretation, because your interpretation will probably be the sole interpretation that people are interacting with. And so you have so much room to play with. And I think that's what Young Justice does so well. Even with the group of superheroes that take center stage, of course you have Dick Grayson, which is a necessity, but you have Artemis, you have Kid Flash, you have obviously Aqualad. And they again, you breathe life into these characters that other interpretations haven't had the opportunity to do.
Absolutely. I'm gonna do let's do two more.
Okay,
so we have got, this one was inspired by your notification, one's got to go: Kim Possible, Fairly Odd Parents, Adventure Time, or Jimmy Neutron.
That's fair.
Yeah. Jimmy Neutron's underrated though.
It is underrated, but I wouldn't watch it again.
Ooh. Interesting.
You know, I've never thought and sat down in my house and been like, Jimmy Neutron, but like Fairly Odd Parents, I think about sometimes.
Yes.
Kim Possible, I love. What was the other one?
Adventure Time. Yeah.
I can't let that one go.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was just like a...
And to bring it all together, we're going to do the channels. One's got to go.
Ooh.
Disney.
Okay.
Cartoon Network. Nickelodeon.
This is actually probably the hardest one.
Yes. You got to think of the catalogs of the bodies of work each channel has. Because I think with all three channels, I fell in love with each channel at different stages.
Mm.
I think the channel I hung on to in my later years was probably Nickelodeon, but I suppose the content was probably more geared towards like teenage. Like Victorious felt like, even though they were all shows dedicated to preteens, Victorious and iCarly felt tonally more adult than Suite Life on Deck.
Yeah.
Or than The Wizards of Waverly Place, even though they were catering to very similar audiences. And then Cartoon Network, in terms of like legacy, like I feel like they've had the most longevity. Mm. If you think of like Dexter's Laboratory, which is a series that came out late 90s, to some of their later creations, like Steven Universe, which was like very much in the mid to late 2010s, like the longevity of that channel and the amount of Powerpuff Girls, Ben 10, yeah, Adventure Time, you know, then you've got the other shows, Kids Next Door,
Amazing World of Gumball,
Amazing Mall of Gumball. Then you've got shows that, you know, that should have got more light, like Generator Rex. Like,
yes, isn't that on Disney? Was that
Cartoon Network? Was Cartoon Network. Okay. Yeah, because they had the Generator Rex and Ben 10 crossover.
Yes, yes. Oh, you're bringing back memories.
Yeah, yeah.
Which one? Do you know what it is? I think Disney is like a classic in everybody's childhood, but they do have a lot of junk. They do have a lot of mid-tier things, and they have very few like that rise to the top. But when they do rise to the top, it's good. Like Gravity Falls,
yeah,
phenomenal.
Recess is a classic.
Yeah, Recess is a classic. Even if you look at like their shows like That's So Raven, they're shows that rise to the top. Nickelodeon, Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest things ever.
If I can't let go of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't, like, even when I was thinking, it makes sense to do Nickelodeon, Avatar The Last Airbender rings in the... SpongeBob as well.
Yes.
Fairly Odd Parents. Danny Phantom.
Yes.
So I actually think I'm going to let go of Disney.
Unfortunately. I agree with you. I think Disney, like... And it's weird because I think Disney has the more noticeable shows like High School Musical, and it's created a lot of, like, the pop icons we see today. But when I just think of, like, catalog and volume of work, I just think for me, I'd probably rank Cartoon Network, then Nickelodeon, then Disney.
Like quality versus quantity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cartoon Network is just like, I think, like I said, Avatar The Last Airbender, out of all three channels, probably like my favorite thing they've created. Yeah. But then it's just like I said, Cartoon Network just has like Ben 10 was a global phenomenon. Like it was. It was different. It was just a crazy period in time. And they made that franchise. It's still going on today.
Mm.
And that franchise came out when I was still a kid.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, man. That was One's Gotta Go. So before we get into like, the main topics, we like to do a little segment called Rare Moment of the Week.
Yes.
Where we like to spotlight a creative in any field that we feel deserves accolades, deserves attention. So Jesse, do you have a rare moment of the week?
I do. Okay, so like most people, I'm a big music head. I love music. But I take special pride in finding musicians that nobody else has found yet. You know that satisfaction when you found someone before everyone else and then you're telling people. I like to joke that I found BTS before everyone found BTS, but that's not true. But like, it's true for me.
Okay.
There's this group called Watermore.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard about it. They're like a rap music collective of like young, like a group of friends in America. And what attracted me to them initially was they had promotion videos for their album where each member told their story of how they discovered music and how they got into the collective. And it's cinematic, you know, it's the way it's filmed is gorgeous. You have like all of these different perspectives and you're shocked that these five guys in the middle of America are able to produce something that's probably rivaling some of the promotions of very big established artists.
Yes.
There's an intention of trying to communicate what the music means to you and what music means to them as a whole. And you connect with that. And they recently released their first EP. And it's like, I was telling my friend earlier that the music is giving, I feel like there's a melancholiness in Gen Z where we're like having nostalgia or we're like having a sense of loss for things that we were promised when we were kids and we looked up into adulthood and now we're here.
Yeah.
It's not there and everything's ruined. And I think they communicate that even when maybe not with lyrics, but in the sounds of their songs and the clinks of like bar drinks of saying, I'm not satisfied in this friendship. I'm not satisfied in this relationship. I think they communicate that so beautifully, but not enough people know about them. So that's who I'm going to spotlight this week.
Say their name again.
Watermore.
Big up Watermore. My rare moment of the week is on the music topic. And it's an art. I've been very happy with the way the UK has been pushing a lot of like singing acts. not specifically R&B, but R&B singing acts. And this artist, she doesn't quite, I don't know where to place her genre-wise, but her name's Amma, formerly known as Amalu. She hasn't released a project since 2023, so this is me begging her to come back. But I think Amma is an artist that has such a rich, raspy voice. And I just love her tone. I love her tonality. And I think her sound, I'd recommend a few songs. Same Old Ways, North Side. Her voice is just so distinct. And I think now that the UK is going through, like, in my opinion, like a renaissance period in terms of like singers. I mean, we have Ray, we have Sasha Keeble, we have Elmeen, you know, K1 is coming out. You know, I feel like we are in such an amazing period when it comes to like UK artists and UK singers that I think, you know, she just definitely needs to come back and throw her hat into the fold because like her stuff is amazing. So yeah.
May I ask a question as like a follow-up?
Sure.
So in terms of the UK music scene, right? Because we see, I feel like when you track across periods of time, you see like there's a lift, there's hype, and then something crushes it. What do you think is crushing it, and how do you think we could like pivot in a way that we can keep this momentum going?
I think it's very much, I have this conversation, but all just are gonna be sick of me having this conversation, but like it's an important one. I think it's an infrastructure issue. I feel like right now, well, let's keep it on the singers, in the singer's place. Ray was making music in England for years, like
for years, yeah,
and she's openly spoken about artist mismanagement. And then what she's gone and done is, I think, seeks some sort of American representation, and then now look at her. And I think it's very much an infrastructure issue in terms of whether it be labels, whether it be, for example, I mentioned that there's a lot of R&B artists coming from the UK, yet we don't have a festival. We did have one, it was DLT, The Recipe, but that only lasted a year. And there's not, if you look at like platforms like Wireless, a lot of them are platforming American artists. So I don't think there's an infrastructure to where our artists can really like grow and breathe. For example, artists like Elmeen and Sasha Keeble and Shea Universe, they've done tiny desks, but it doesn't feel like our major journalistic platforms are highlighting the fact that these guys are going on major platforms in the States. And then what about the platforms that we have here? Are we really, you know, promoting the artists that we have at our disposal? So for me, long story short, I just think it's an infrastructure thing. And also us as consumers to be more vocal and go out and support these artists at live shows, support your local your local venue that does open mic nights. I think very much supporting artists from a grassroots perspective is so important to their growth and development. But then there's only a certain point that we as consumers can take things. The labels, the powers that be have to be doing more in the UK.
No, I think that's very eloquent. I think you like encapsulate it. I agree. I think the infrastructure is not very supportive of artists that are doing something unique. I think they're always trying to find a British copy of an American thing when in fact we create, because we're a different culture, we are a different mix of people. And so the things that are going to come out, the uniqueness, the things that we should highlight, like in Ray and other artists that have made it massive, you know, Ray, there's no American version of Ray, and that's what makes her so special. But I think artists, are, labels are always trying to find like, we want an American version of Taylor Swift in the UK. And it's like, why are we
because
doing that?
Even if you look at like, for example, like the UK, like what we had a lot of, if you think about the noughties, had a lot of bands, had a lot of groups, right? And obviously like Spice Girls, Sugar Babes, stuff like that. But I was very much coming from the, I don't want to say it's a direct correlation, but from what it looks like to me, it comes from the popularity of the Backstreet Boys in America, popularity of then New Edition in America, and then slowly and surely, we bled that into our culture with Take That and Spice Girls. So it always feels like, not to say that we in the UK were hopping on trends from the States, but it very much feels like we're the last people to know. And sometimes we're the last people to know about our own acts. And then you double that down with acts that are considered more urban, that have a much nicher audience, it definitely feels like we're the last to know. Because like I said, Ray was here for ages, and it feels like we only give a damn about her now that she's, you know, being applauded on these major stages in the States, where it's like, we had her here. Mm. Like, she was here for years. Like, where was the Jonathan Ross appearances? Where were the major
events? Yeah,
for her. So yeah, like, I just think, yeah, infrastructure wise.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just curious.
No worries. Trust me, it's a topic that I could go on about for ages. But let's go on to like one of your passions. I want to talk about, I'm sure you've heard of the term the Great Shift.
I have.
And this is a term that I've like seen appear, and it's on TikTok and on social media for a while now. For those of you who don't know, the Great Shift is basically a term describing the spike in popularity of anime and manga as a medium. And I want to get your thought. I want to get your anime and manga origin story. When did you become a fan? And like, what was the series that really got you into the medium?
My dad's a big anime fan.
Really?
Yeah. So back in like Lagos.
Oh, this is interesting.
He used to collect Dragon Ball like box sets, like the anime, like to see on video. And I have an older sister that's about like 10 years older than me. And so when she was growing up, they would watch Dragon Ball together. They would watch Naruto. They would watch Sailor Moon. So when I was born, I was kind of like born into a family that already liked it.
Osmosis, yeah.
Exactly. And so spending time with my dad was watching superhero films as well. He's super into it. It would be watching superhero films. He had this thing where he didn't like baby shows. So when I was younger, he was like, we're not watching Peppa Pig because cool. I'm not going to sit down and watch this with you. Let's watch Naruto. Let's watch Dragon Ball Z. Let's watch something that you can at least learn something from. And so he's the one that got me into it. And so when, you know, I got access to the internet, I was just kind of doing my own thing. Just what anime? Watch this. Okay, cool. Watch this. Cool, cool, cool. And now I'm giving my dad recommendations. So that's pretty much how I got into the it. Cycle, my dad was into it.
Yeah. And did you, and have you noticed like, because you've probably been in, you've been into it for like, I'd say most of your life.
Mm.
When did you notice that there was a spike in popularity?
Like, I think anime and manga was always like this niche thing.
Yeah.
Like when you go to school, even when you get recommendations, it was always word of mouth. And it was always a thing that if you said you were interested in, it would be like, oh, really? Like, you know, these cartoons, it's like weird. And then I'd have more friends that would show interest in it. They would ask me for recommendations, or I'd find more people to talk about it with in school. And then I think it was the pandemic where I really, really noticed a shift of like people just like, I'd go on social media and like people are doing fan edits of One Piece and they're doing fan edits of this. And then, you know, Crunchyroll is like spiking like crazy and everybody's getting it. And I think it was definitely the pandemic where I noticed there was a great shift and it was cool to watch anime anymore. It was cool to watch anime now. And it wasn't this weird niche thing anymore, which I love. I love that more people are getting into the medium.
I love it. Do you know, it's very interesting because funny enough, like one of my degree essays was about the influence that anime has had on Western cinema.
Mm.
And I spoke about movies like Akira and so on and so forth. But it's interesting because I grew up watching anime just from before I even knew it was anime.
Mm.
And I feel like most people's early memory of watching cartoons involves an anime. Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, yeah. Beyblade, right? But I think a lot of those people, a lot of the time, at that point in time, we didn't recognize anime as like its own kind of distinct medium.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of funnel, like people, if you tell them Pokemon's anime, they'll be like, oh yeah, but it doesn't process. Right. And I think slowly but surely through series, like for me, like my first proper anime that I acknowledged wasn't anime was Naruto.
Mm.
And then over time, like I remember when Attack on Titan first dropped, which was around 2012.
Mm.
And I remember being on, you know, the dark ages of Twitter, the medieval ages of Twitter. And I knew that series was like one of the ones that really got the ball rolling. But it's interesting how like, and the reason why I'm talking about the Great Shift is interesting that overtly Eastern medium is getting so popular in the West. If you look at like things that we normalize, like because of anime, like Japanese names or pronunciations are a lot more normalized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very interesting, because especially when it comes to the States, like a lot of the stuff we consume comes from Hollywood, is very Americanized. Why do you think these stories that we see in anime that have very Eastern themes, very Eastern proverbs and ideologies are resonating with the global Western audience?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I would say anime and manga is a medium that rewards patience and requires patience and time. It's not a medium that in first episode, if you're like locked in, is going to give you everything in the first episode and take it back. I think the way in which anime and manga is constructed, and I think it inherently reflects the values within Eastern cultures and society, is that the storytelling and the message they want to communicate is prized over the audience. You know, they are going to take their time to tell the story because that's how the story will be best given, you know, and I think that is why it feels different. And people are watching this and they recognize that through giving this patience, the reward is so amazing. You know, being able to see a character's journey and not be cut short because, oh, we ran out of budget, so it's the end of the season, you know, or, oh, we're going to get rid of this character because, you know, something's going on. We just don't think it's popular anymore with the young kids. And it's like, no, we're going to tell this story in the most authentic way the manga writer wants to tell the story. And that is also because you have situations of anime where audiences are complaining, I hate this ending. And then the manga person's like, that's your own concern. This is how I wanted to tell the story. And so I think it is almost a very pure way of consuming someone's artwork. It's art at the end of the day.
And I think the reason why anime, I go back to what your dad said in terms of like, you didn't want you watching like Peppa Pig and so on and so forth. I think the way, especially, let's say Battle Shonen and a lot of the anime we get exposed to at a young age, obviously they cater to like younger demographics, but I think they don't baby the audience. I feel like a lot of, even in the structure, I think anime was my first time engaging in serialized television. Because if you look at a lot of the cartoons you grew up with, episodic. Each episode is self-contained, and yeah, there might be some things that cross over in the grander narratives, but each episode is meant to be consumed and congested in one sitting, and then you can come back tomorrow and it'll be a completely different topic and with completely different characters. But anime was the first time me as a kid I engaged in a narrative that was, no, you have to watch from episode one. Mm. And there is foreshadowing. There are things that are referenced from the part. Like, it's serialized storytelling. Mm. And I think as a kid, I really appreciated that in my stories. And it challenged me. And I thought that, especially engaging with anime as a kid, I thought that was so important. Because I feel like now, especially now that we live in the era of like, instant gratification, I feel like it's very important to have stories that take their time. Mm. And I'm someone who's still trying to catch up to One Piece, but I appreciate the length. Mm-hmm. Because it's very rare that we get stories that span that long, but still have a narrative through line. It's not a reboot. It's not milking a franchise. No, like, it's Oda's intent from day one was to create a saga. Mm. And that's what he's done.
And I think also, just to piggyback off your point, is that anime and manga, they don't assume stupidity of its audience. There's no need to over-explain something. You either get it or you get it. You hear the message or you don't. And maybe you'll get it 5 years later when you watch it when you're older, or you may never understand it, or maybe you'll get it when somebody explains it to you. But again, there's not this, I'm going to assume that my audience is absolutely stupid and it doesn't understand anything, so it's going to over-explain. I completely agree.
Yeah, and also, I just think, social media in general, let me ask you this. This is a good question. Why do you think anime and manga specifically has resonated with Black audiences? Ooh. Because I'm seeing a lot of, when you talk about like people who have really like put like anime on their back and really like helped boost the pop, I think of creators like RDC. I think of, and I'm seeing a lot of black audiences and black creators really like resonate with anime, specifically like, especially when it comes to boys battle shonen. What do you think is in the messaging and in the themes that resonates to black audiences so much?
I think ultimately, in the way in which Japanese manga unfolds, particularly battle shonen, is always an underdog, typically somebody who is, for whatever reason in society, is deemed as unfavorable and less likely to achieve whatever goal that wants to be. That could be in Naruto, him wanting to become Hokage. It could be, you know, Luffy wants to become the Pirate King. It could be Inazuma Eleven. They want to win the football match and they're just unlikely. There's always a sense of an underdog, but it's also how that underdog interacts within the power structures and systems within it. And I think Black people resonate with that, because unfortunately in the society that we've created, we are the underdogs for whatever reason. And there's a sense of empowerment seeing in whatever lens that the anime is trying to capture it in. You know, there is an underdog and this is the, you know, moral code that they're applying to, and this is the resilience that they're having, and this is the problems they're encountering. And it's kind of like, I always say stories and anime and manga, they're a way of philosophically interacting with the world without having to interact with the world. Like, they're a little bit of a playground. And so it allows Black people to kind of confront in a way that's safe some of those things that are particularly challenging about existing in the society.
Absolutely. If you see, like, a lot of, like, even when it comes to removing battle shonen, even when it comes to seinen, like, I think of, like, a character like Guts, and he's kind of finding... What the meaning of life is, finding, like, his whole narrative arc is him finding joy in a world that's literally structured against him. Mm. Or stories about finding purpose in a society where you feel disillusioned. Yeah, I feel like those themes, like, resonate with us, and a lot of the time they resonate with us subconsciously. Mm. Like, as a kid, you're not really processing these things, but there's something that's gravitating you towards these mediums. There's a reason why Goku going Super Saiyan resonates with so much, and there's a reason why Frieza is racist.
Yeah,
I'm sure Toriyama didn't write this as an allegory for, like, the as for Black people specifically, but he definitely wrote that with those who are marginalized in mind. Mm. And I feel like, yeah, these, and it's very interesting the fact that we go back to these stories being Eastern. Mm. I can't make a commentary on Eastern storytelling as a whole, but I think it's very interesting that stories from the mediums from the East have resonated with people who have been marginalized by Western society.
Yeah.
And I think that parallel there, it's so fascinating.
It's so, and also, if you look at a lot of Western storytelling, you can kind of trace it back, like with everything, to ancient Greeks. Yeah. You know, very Aristotelian ideas of, you know, man versus man, or like this Greek, you know, the Greek hero is perfect, you know, when, you know, his dad is a god, you know, he's super, like, built and he has challenges in life, but he's genetically and divinely predisposed to be perfect, to complete all of these challenges, you know. And obviously, again, there's still interesting storytelling mediums with it, that whereas I think Eastern storytelling takes very the opposite. It's again like this whole notion of the underdog, and it's not they're probably not the most perfect person. And maybe it's because, again, I can't speak on Japanese philosophy the best, but maybe it's because Eastern society is more collectivist. And so as a collective whole, how do we uphold society? Whereas a Western society can be visualized to be quite individualized. How does one person achieve all their goals, but how does collective achieve all of their goals? Yeah. So maybe because of the way in which society is structured, they pay more attention to the interactions of people within other people and how that person being uplifted doesn't affect the other person. And even when you have, like, an anti-hero, you know, their devastation is the fact that they haven't remembered the collective.
Yeah.
Whereas an anti-hero in Western media, it's their devastation is because, you know, they got too much pride. It's not about the community, it's about themselves.
Yeah. And a lot of, and it's so funny because I think back to, like, villains like, for example, Pain, where it's like in Naruto, he's taken the notion of, like, world peace, but he's removed everybody else's freedom of choice and imposed, and it goes back to the idea of the anti-hero, where they've forgotten about the collective and imposed their, that's a really good point of view. And speaking of, like, how these characters, like, combat, like, the world that disenfranchises them, let's talk about power systems.
My favorite topic.
Let's talk. I think that's the video where I was like, I've always had these thoughts, but you articulated, like, your love for power systems in the way I was like, yes. Like, talk to me about, like, what fascinates you the most about power systems inherently.
I think, as a lover of fantasy and anime and manga and superheroes, I think I've always interacted with stories where powers are important, you know, and magic's important. But I've noticed that there would be some things I watched and I'm like, this is horrible. Like, what are we doing here? And there'll be some things I've watched where this encapsulates something perfectly. And so I think I just kind of become obsessed. I mean, the writer Brandon Sanderson, and he's very famous for, like, works of books like Mistborn and The Way of Kings. And he said something like, the author's ability to solve conflict with magic is solely dependent on the reader's ability to understand the magic system. And so I think once I read that quote, I was like, okay, this makes sense. Like, if I can't understand the power system, then anything that you are trying to do within the power system will not make sense. And the whole story falls apart. Power systems are complete. I think they hold stories together. They're so important.
They are absolutely important. And I think the greatest power system I've seen in any fiction I've read is Nen from Hunter x Hunter.
You know what? I was going to bring it up. Because when you sent me some of the things we were going to talk about, I was thinking, yeah, what is my favorite power system? I asked my dad, Nen. I asked my friend, Nen. Like, everybody collectively who's watched Hunter x Hunter comes away thinking, like, this is the best one.
Because I think Nen, right? The reason why I think Nen isn't, for me, the pinnacle is because, one, if you just look at, like, you can analyze it from a scientific perspective.
Mm.
Togashi's Nen chart in terms of, like, specialists, emitters, like, the fact that Togashi explains Nen as if it's just a way of life, as if it's like a degree you could study, but also I love the fact that the power system is something that can be evolved. And it's something that is directly informs us about the characters, because the characters get to literally form their hatsu, form their abilities. Okay, if a character has agency over the abilities they form, why have they made the abilities they've made? And a perfect example is Kurapika.
Best use of Nen and power system in any media.
Because his power system is very tunnel visioned. It's specifically, how do I combat the members of the Phantom Troop?
Yeah.
And I find the fact that he uses chains so poetic, because yes, he's chaining his opponents, but he's also chained himself to this path of vengeance. And then have you read the manga?
No.
Okay, I won't spoil. But it's the fact that all of his abilities are directly tied to this singular focus, and the fact that he becomes slightly ineffective when he's confronted with people that aren't in the Phantom Troop.
Yeah.
I just feel like and then the idea of Gon sacrificing his entire potential's worth of Nen to combat Pito, which serves as a parallel to I think Nen is such a amazing power system, because it tells us, it informs us about the characters and what they want, while also being an engaging power system that creates a lot of dynamism in fights. Mm-hmm. No two Hunter x Hunter fights are the same.
Yeah.
You can, in Hunter x Hunter, you could have a dodgeball game be just as intense as a Heaven Arenas fight.
Yeah.
And I just think Togashi is an absolute genius for creating that.
And what I'd love to add, because all of your points, like, tick, 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 the way Togashi explains costs in the power system is phenomenal, because a power system has to have costs. You know, there's no power that is absolutely infinite.
Limitless,
okay? It's terrible power system writing if there is no... Maybe the potential is limitless, but there has to be things that prevent people from just being cracked,
yeah.
You know? So I was like, no, like, the costs of using Nen, like, is the fact that, you know, Kurapika, he can't do the other thing. It's the fact that if you want to be as powerful as possible, you can say, okay, I can only use this special ability with this one person, and it's the most powerful ability ever, but that's the end.
Having certain Nen abilities with conditions in mind. And again, I think, because when I hear people talk about power systems, it's Nen and Stands. Those are the two power systems I see held up. And the reason why I prefer Nen over Stands is because characters have agency over their power.
Yeah.
I think Stands are amazing, but I think the thing that I prefer, that makes me lean towards Nen, is because Stands is very, okay, you're given a set of cards and it's up to the Stand user to use and manipulate their abilities the best way they can, which is amazing. It creates a lot of potential for scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, with Nen, it's like everything is meticulous. Even the characters, even in universe, the characters are meticulous about the powers they bestow upon themselves. And I just find that touch right there is just what sets it above for me.
And also, we'll keep going on for Nen forever.
Yeah,
But also, I love, and this is kind of similar to the giver power system in Gachiyakuza, I love a power system that is individualized to the user, so it tells you some information about the user's character or backstory. So when we discovered Killer was a transmuter,
yes,
and then we're like, why do you have electricity powers? Well, I used to be electric shocks as a kid. And you're like, oh, that's not that's not very, and it tells you more about the character. Exactly. It gives you insight. And I love that, because a power system, at the end of the day, is a storytelling tool. And I think writers should use it to their disposal in the same way as well.
Yeah. And going back to Western and Eastern, I'd never, until I'd consumed anime, I'd never seen the powers be represented in such a way. I think a lot of, like, when we talk about, like, superheroes, like, superheroes have, like, one set of powers, and, you know, there might be some evolutions here, some evolutions there, but usually we know Superman can fly, laser, heat vision, so on and so forth. It's interesting how, like, again, comic books and anime manga represent power. In a sense, it's interesting how, like, in these comics, like, a lot of these characters revert back to the status quo. Mm. But within anime, it's always about the evolution.
Mm.
It's always about, okay, Gon episode one does not have the same power set that he does in the final episodes. Naruto definitely does not have that same power set. And obviously, there are issues with that method of storytelling, because you have power creep, power escalation, and you have a series that starts off with ninja that ends with aliens.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? But I feel like there's, in anime and manga, there's that constant escalation, where when in more traditional Western stories, there's the status quo.
Mm.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's just the difference in the way those stories are told. Mm. I think with Naruto, again, we're starting from point one, and the writer's trying to get to point 50.
Yeah.
And they've mapped it out, and the power system is a tool to, you know, convey that storytelling message. But with comics have been going on forever. Most comics that are being written are building off of pre-existing IP. And so they are limited by things that exist. You know, we can't, like, suddenly make Batman start flying.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can if we do an Elseworld title, but it can't be related to anything else. And it has to be very self-contained. And then by the end of the 12th issue, we need to, like, never think about this again. So I just think it's just in the nature of which, how these stories are constructed and communicated and brought across. But I mean, again, like, you have shows like Invincible, you have shows like Arcane. Like, you know, I think there's Western media is, like, slowly, and Avatar The Last Airbender.
Of course.
But that's so heavily inspired by anime.
It's so thematically Eastern.
It is. So, like I said, like, in my head, Avatar The Last Airbender is an anime, but it's not.
It's not, but it's so, just even the imagery and the things it draws from is so non-Western.
Yeah.
In terms of course the writers are West, but even, like, I was watching a thing, all the martial arts they drew from the East. Like, it's such a thing, and not to say that, oh, the East is inherently better than the West, because I feel like sometimes you can get into, like, I can't remember the exact term, but you can overly romanticize Eastern culture and stuff like that. But it is a thing narratively that I've noticed, that there are differences in the types of stories we tell and how we tell them.
Yeah.
But
I do want to say, though, I think it's not necessarily that there are people, Western media can't produce these stories.
No,
I think
not.
It's just that they're not giving the same level of funding and attention within Western medium storytelling. I guess it kind of relates a little bit to films, and you hear this conversation a lot in films where people complain, hey, I haven't seen a good film that's not from, like, you know, a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh franchise series. Yeah. But it's like, well, no, these films exist, but they're not funding them because nobody's going to go watch them.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of reflects in storytelling. I think those stories are there, and, like, those comics are being produced, but they're just not being pushed, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Like, I think, like, you asked me, like, one of my favorite TV shows. I think one of my favorite TV shows to come out in the last, let's say, five, six years is Lovecraft Country.
Ooh.
Have you watched?
No,
I haven't. Okay, Lovecraft Country. If I could summarize it, it's set in, like, how much specific time period, but it's set in, like, segregation era, Deep South, and the story very much covers different Black myths.
Ooh.
And I call it, to give it a short title, I call it an adult Stranger Things.
Okay.
Think of, like, the hijinks of, like, the Stranger Things cast with, like, all, like, with Vecna and all that stuff. But it's set in, like, the deep South, and racist owners have a monopoly on magic.
Oh, okay.
Have a monopoly on magic. And it follows the story of Atticus, and he's encountering these weird astral beings in his town while still having to fight racism. Mm. And I think it's one of the more, and it's one of the things where like the story very much touches into like deep Southern culture, deep Black Southern culture when it comes to like, you know, ancestral practices, when it comes to that, the roots and stuff like that. And I just think Lovecraft Country was such a unique show. And I love the representation. It wasn't just Black representation. There's a character that delves into like Korean Korean lore. Like she like, I don't want to give away a story, but like it talks about like the nine-tailed fox, but like not the Japanese one, the Korean one.
Yeah.
And I just feel like stories that are able, because like you said, a lot of the stories we touch upon, you can trace their roots or their narrative roots back to Greece and back to Greek mythology. I love stories that really tap into different roots. And I think that's why like anime and manga have worked so well, because they're inherently Japanese mediums. And they're giving us, as a Western audience, they're giving us access to a culture we don't often see.
Mm.
And I thought like the thing in storytelling, especially in the West, especially, you know, in America, the UK, where you have these big metropolitan cities filled with different people, with different walks of life, I feel like those stories, those cultures are so rich in terms of things we could use in cinema, in television, that haven't been tapped into for whatever reason, whether it be funding, whether it be lack of opportunity. I just feel like, especially the world is so much more globalized, but we're seeing very similar linear stories.
Mm. And I also think like when you track back, you know, the history of film and media and the way it's intentionally misrepresented minorities to construct certain social narratives, you can tell how like we've ended up in the place we're at. And you can then tell why anime and manga, when we're given the opportunity to access these stories, just blows up like exponentially. Even you think K-dramas,
yes,
blow up exponentially. Because now, because of like this kind of leveling of streaming services, which has drawbacks, of course, but it does level the playing field a little bit in terms of distribution and what you can access, like Parasite winning, you know, and one of the best films ever.
Squid Game becoming the most popular show in Netflix history.
It's a leveler where people from their own backgrounds now have the opportunity to be the ones to communicate their own stories, you know, funded by their own people to get the message to the world. And absolutely, I think that's so important.
That is tremendously important. This will be the last topic. Let's talk about the MCU. let's get your general... your general thoughts of the MCU. Like, talk to me about your MCU journey. Like, were you somebody who was already invested in the beginning, or were you someone who joined, you know, the craze later on? And then what are your thoughts now? Talk to me through your journey.
Yeah, so, like, of course, with my dad being into superheroes.
Yes.
You know, grew up, we watched all of the Spider-Man, like, you know, before the MCU, we watched the X-Men. You know, I was, like, I was a Marvel girly. I am more of a DC girly now because I read the comics and things. Nice. But I was a Marvel girly. I was like, no, this makes sense. I put Spider-Man, everything. And then Iron Man came out. I was like, come on, like, this is... And then the universe started connecting. I was like, wait, this is so good. Definitely, like, that whole ride up until Endgame was just... phenomenal.
A moment in cinematic history, for sure.
No, 100%. And I think that's something, whenever somebody critiques the MCU, you can't take away from what is the Russo brothers. The Russo brothers did, bringing all of those different facets of the universe together and getting people to the point where they were leaving, like people were booking. When was the last time you booked a cinema ticket in advance for a movie that hadn't come out yet? A month in advance.
I remember, so I was in university for Black Panther. I saw Black Panther, Infinity War and Endgame in the same cinema. And I remember the lines.
Ugh.
And it was all us students, like, because we said respectfully, we don't care about the kids. All of it, like, it felt like the entire university was in one cinema, one gallery or cinema in the middle, because it was a moment in, like, they made the cinema, the MCU made the cinematic experience an event.
Yeah.
It was the sin, like, before, when you used to consume movies, like, oh, this was a really good movie, I'd love to talk about it, but the just pulling up to the cinema was an event.
It was so serious that people, they had to do, like, on social media, like a time period where you can't do spoilers or you would get, like, doxxed. Yeah. Like, it was that serious. It was like, we have a 1 week period where no spoilers, nobody's allowed to talk about this movie because everybody needs to see this movie before we can discuss it. Yeah. That's how serious it was.
It was serious.
Yeah. So my thoughts on the MCU now, I think they should have stopped at Endgame. I don't see why we continued. Maybe it's because I'm used to comic books having reboots, and I'm very comfortable with this idea of, yeah, we're done with this storyline, let's move on. But again, I think it's this thing of people like continuing story. They like dragging things out until they don't like it anymore. So that's my thoughts on the MCU. I think people have MCU fatigue with good reason. It's going to be hard to tell a good MCU story now because there's so much precondition set before. I'm watching an MCU movie, I'm like, how does this make sense? Because, you know, when we're talking about Infinity War, this happened and this, like, I have so much context that I'm comparing to.
I think the MCU is so funny. The MCU has inherited one of the issues I have with comics. Which is the MCU was like, the MCU at its foundation was to kind of replicate the cinema, the shared universe experience that you get in comics, and it did that masterfully. It's the first, it's the first of its kind to ever do that. But then what happens with comics is that, okay, if I ask, if the the classic tale, I ask, somebody asked me to read Spider-Man, I asked them which one. And there's so much pre-reading before you're reading. I tie this back to the MCU with this, the TV shows. Now you have pivotal narrative arcs happening off screen in a separate TV show. Already, it was a big ask to get audiences to watch multiple films that connect, but fine. It's all within one medium of cinema. But then now you've branched out and connected television to it. And now you have multiple TV series that branch back into the MCU. So you, I mean, you can just watch the movies linearly, but the MCU has expanded to the point where, yes, there's more content, but because there's more content, I feel it alienates certain audiences, because now the gap between you missing a film isn't just a film. It's a film plus the miniseries plus the secondary film that connects back into the universe. And I think it's overload. And also, I feel like a lot of most of the characters we started the journey with are no longer with us. So it feels like the anchors of the universe are gone. Now you can still create stories through that, but I feel like they should go back to telling singular stories. And you could still keep the framework of the universe, but I think now everything is so incumbent on, we're building up to something. Why can't you tell just a simple narrative with a character rather than it having to be a quintessential piece to the entire universe? Because right now we don't have any anchors anymore. Our anchors are gone. So you're going to have to get us invested into these characters as individual characters rather than pieces to the puzzle of a wider universe.
I completely agree. I also think that I'm not opposed to having characters dip in and out. You know, you have a one character show up in a Spider-Man film. Great. Amazing. That's a little niche thing for me because I've watched it, but it shouldn't be to the point where I'm taking my non-comic book friend and she's like, who's that? And I'm like, well, from this TV show and this TV show and this. But I also have a problem with the MCU because there's certain hero, like I liked how everything built up. I thought it was amazing. But as I get older, Spider-Man shouldn't have gone to space. You know, my Spider-Man should not be facing an intergalactic threat against the universe.
My Spider-Man. Oh, you've touched something. My biggest issue with the Tom Holland franchise, with the Tom Holland series, is that where is the neighborhood? Spider-Man is a character that's quintessentially tied to New York.
Yeah.
He's friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Even in Infinity War, he says to Tony Stark, how could I be friendly neighborhood Spider-Man if there's no neighborhood to save? But we never see him interact with his community.
He's never saved his neighborhood once.
The first movie was in Washington, D.C. Second movie, he was gallivanting in Europe. The third movie was a crossover movie, which people love Nowhere Home, but I felt like it was a great event. But for me, the fanfare felt unearned because I felt like Spider-Man hadn't gone through his arc of being New York superhero yet. And that's just what I want from my Spider-Man stories. So there's a lot of subjectivity there. But for me, I agree with you where it's like Spider-Man, if you're going to have Spider-Man being in space should feel like a bigger moment because we've seen him tied to the streets. It should be a fish out of water feeling. But instead, it just felt like, oh, yeah, he just he's one of the lads.
Yeah, like, why not?
Why not?
Give him an oxygen mask, send him up. It's just, I get what you mean also, and I think there's something to be said about Spider-Man's character is so beautifully about his community and how he connects and how he's awkward and how he's unsure and how he, because Miles Morales, the Spider-Verse, does this beautifully.
Beautifully.
And it's like how it's like this like taking on the Spider-Man role is something that's quite heavy and weighty. And unfortunately, because it did exist within the MCU, and again, this is what's happening with movies like Shang-Chi and like other IP that's coming out from the MCU, because it has to exist within the MCU, characterizations and these important story developments get doxed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love the fact that you brought up, I think Into the Spider, depending on how the, obviously the trilogy ends, but I think it's a massive feat narratively what those movies do, because they literally, the movies are, the second point, multiverse, but the movies are so character focused.
Mm.
Miles's journey is, even though he's dealing with these multiversal threats, his biggest issue is being understood by his family. Like, it's all, the movies are still very much about community while dealing with these, like, it's not lost to me that the movie very much popularized the term canon event.
Yeah.
But it's still, when I think about the emotional beats of the film, I think about Miles' conversation with his mom, the iconic scene now of Gwen and Miles sitting on,
oh, yeah,
which has now been referenced throughout so many different shows, whether it's Arcade, Invincible. Like, I just feel like that series of films, despite the grand scope of it, still feel so deeply personable. And I feel like that's, it's proof of concept that you can tell these massive stories while still keeping the focus, the characters.
If some crazy person decided to give me the reins of the MCU, I'd like to start every, like, reboot completely. Whatever they're doing with Secret Wars, I don't really care. They can finish what they want to do. And then I'd just be like, okay, Spider-Man, you're going to be your own separate thing now. Like, you're just going to be friendly, and we'll keep doing you as long as you want to do you. We'll develop your stories on your own. Because I don't think Tom Holland's done yet, and I don't think his story's done yet.
No.
And I want to see that story carried out. And then I'd go to X-Men, because now Disney has acquired Fox, right? The biggest thing when Disney acquired Fox was X-Men. Like, that's the Spider-Man and X-Men are the heavy hitters of the MC, like the Marvel Comics. And so I think I would, because there's so many beautiful stories to be told, and especially in today's like sociopolitical climates, having the discussions with the mutants, having that illustrated on scene,
and
I think that's powerful storytelling.
And that's why, like, I'm nervous about the X-Men, because the X-Men are so so thematically rich that I don't want them bogged down with the wider politics of how does this relate to the wider MCU. The X-Men story
is big enough.
It's big. There's so much. Magneto alone is enough. Then you've got the whole idea of mutants in society being an allegory for, again, marginalized people.
Yeah.
Like, mutants can't just be other powered beings. Their experience is unique in the fact that they are marginalized and discriminated
against.
And that's
why you have to reboot it. Because you can't add mutants into this world when aliens have invaded New York 25 times.
Exactly.
It's like, not gonna mean anything.
It's not gonna mean, and you can't fabricate a conflict where you guys are openly pro-Hulk. Do you know what I'm saying? It's universe. It doesn't make sense for you to now have this prejudice against mutants, but then, like, you love the Avengers. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So I would do a clean, fresh reboot, and I'd start, like, I'd do an X-Men universe. I'd do an X-Men storyline. I'd do, like, you know, obviously Wolverine has loads of films. I'd do a Magneto film. I'd do that origin story between Magneto and Professor X as they're younger, how they build that up. Like, I'd do those stories and allow that to build out in the X-Men universe. And maybe Spider-Man says hello once in a short cameo for 5 minutes, and then he goes back home.
Last point before we wrap up. And I feel like when I knew the MCU had lost the plot was when the selling point became the cameos. I look at this Avengers Doomsday marketing, and it's like, this person's in this movie, and it's like, are you selling the film based off the cameos?
It's so straight. And then also when you see, like, what's it called, Nightcrawler,
yeah,
who plays a Nightcrawler, Alan something, sorry, yeah, I forgot, they were asking him, like, so what's the plot? He said, I don't know the plot, I just showed up and it was a green screen and I did my role to no one. I don't even know who I'm acting with. I just think, as again, I think there is this question of, like, the death of cinema and how, you know, that's going to affect, you know, film and storytelling. But I do think as much as I love the MCU and as much as I love these stories, I would love people to pay more attention to original IP, original heroes.
Absolutely.
Like Sinners is a beautiful example of how you can create original IP, rich music, rich storytelling, rich world, beautiful hero, end of movie.
This is, when it comes to like the end of decade wrap up, for me, the two most important films for me as a cinema fan, Sinners and Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Everything Everywhere All at Once. Masterful.
That film, right? Those films are two films that aren't attached to existing IP, but are very much about telling their own stories, and they highlight ingenuity in cinema. They highlight, because Everything Everywhere All at Once is a masterstroke in VFX. Oh. It's something that pushes the medium forward.
Yes.
Sinners, Ryan Coogler's campaign for IMAX.
I went and bought the IMAX, £20 ticket.
Was so important for pushing cinema forward. And I feel like what you said about supporting films that aren't attached to established IPs is so important.
It's so, like, I cannot articulate, particularly, especially because obviously Netflix has now bought Warner Brothers. People are like, I don't know what's going on there. I think it's so important now to support cinema, support storytelling, support, like, really, like, storytelling. I always say, like, as humans, we've been given this beautiful gift of art and being able to create things to tell and envision our internal world and interact with our external world. Don't take this gift for granted because of the convenience of not wanting to learn something new or explore something new. Go out, watch new IP, go watch a TV show that's had 50 episodes that you've never heard before in a different language. Like, allow yourself to explore the richness of the human experience through these mediums that people are trying to tell. I think that's important.
I think that's an amazing way to end the episode. Jesse, love you coming on the show.
Thank
I'm definitely gonna have you back
me.
On back on again. But tell the people where they can find you at.
So I post a lot on TikTok, particularly if you like the content we're talking about today. It's Jesse Loves. So I'm always in the comments. I will talk to everyone because I love talking about what I love. I also have a podcast. I mainly talk a little bit more about science there, but also do reference, because my life is anime and manga. A lot of those manga is called the Female Genius Podcast, and we have a lot of amazing women who come on and talk about their work as well, which is incredible. So please do go and join me on those platforms, and thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
No, this wasn't, honestly, this is a conversation I've been wanting to have, and I feel like having it with you was just like perfect. Like, there's so many parts of this episode I can't wait to clip up.
Thank you.
But since you guys are here, make sure you like, share, comment, and subscribe. We'll have all of Jesse's links down below. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, follow us on TikTok, help us get to 10K on TikTok, please. But yeah, be in the comment section. Tell us what parts you resonate with. But yeah, this has been The Right Podcast. We are signing out. Catch you in the next one. Peace.